This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. There was the movie theater shooting in Colorado this summer, the tragedy at Sandy Hook's elementary school 2 weeks ago, and most recently, the firefighter shootings in New York. These events have caused a debate over the accessibility and availability of guns, especially high-powered semi-automatic weapons. The right to bear arms has and always will be a contentious topic, as a growing number of organizations call for stricter gun control laws. In October, L.C. Morris reported on how North Carolina handles gun control.
Gun control is any law, policy, practice, or proposal designed to restrict or limit the possession, production, importation, shipment, sale, and/or use of guns or other firearms by private citizens. Most commonly, the guns in question are personal firearms, typically handguns and long guns. Lad Everett is the communications director for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence.
There is no other free nation on the face of the earth that has failed to address this problem like we have failed.
The Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, or CSGV, seeks to secure freedom from gun violence through research, strategic engagement, and effective policy advocacy.
When we think of buying a gun, most of us tend to think of going into a gun store, right? You walk into Bob's Guns and, you know, Bob is a federally licensed firearms dealer. And when you go in, you undergo that instant computer check. And if you pass that check, you then get your gun. That's one way to buy a gun in this country. But in your own state, for example, North Carolina and about 40 or more other states, you can buy a gun through a private sale where a private individual, a private firearm seller, is legally allowed to sell you that gun without conducting any background check or maintaining any paper record of that sale.
Purchasing a legal firearm from a licensed dealer means adhering to federal and state requirements, which include a background check. However, a person-to-person sale can be made with no type of background check at all. Even with certain background checks in place, such as searching for evidence of mental commitment, wanted persons, or domestic violence offenders, Everett says the information is not detailed enough.
Number one, the screening is incredibly narrow. It's all it is an instant computer check. It is not a background investigation. It is something that is over in a matter of minutes. And if the databases that are checked do not find a disqualifying record, all the gun dealer would see is approve or deny on a computer screen. They're not seeing anything about your background. The FBI NICS database, which is supposed to maintain disqualifying records from around the states, is missing millions of records that the states have yet to submit to it. So very often, people who should be prohibited are being approved through this system.
Recent high-profile shootings, such as the July 2012 Batman movie massacre in Colorado, bring the issue of mental competency to the forefront of the gun control issue.
The criteria for being prohibited based on mental health reasons is very narrow. The only two categories of Americans for mental health reasons who would be prohibited from buying guns are those who have been involuntarily committed, forced to go into a mental institution, or those who have been formally adjudicated by a court either as mental incompetence or as a threat to themselves or others. In the universe of severely mentally ill Americans, very, very few fall into one of those two narrow categories. And if you do not, you can legally stockpile all the guns you want. And again, that gun dealer sees nothing about your background. When James Holmes, for example, or Jared Loughner, or Sung-hee Cho, when these mentally ill mass shooters went in and legally bought guns, some of them on multiple occasions, the dealer saw absolutely nothing about their mental health history. All they saw was a blip on a screen that said approve.
In August of this year, white supremacist shooter and former Fort Bragg Army soldier Wade Michael Page went on a rampage at a Sikh temple in suburban Milwaukee, killing six people. According to the Fayetteville Observer, Page obtained five permits in North Carolina to purchase pistols in 2008. The North Carolina Rifle and Pistol Association requires all intended handgun recipients obtain a pistol purchase permit from the local sheriff at a cost of $5 per permit.
Well, I mean, for the most part, if you're talking about a semi-automatic firearm, which would be a firearm that basically fires one bullet with each pull of the trigger, those guns are wide open available on the civilian market. And you know, you could buy, for example, you mentioned, I think, an AK-47. You could buy semi-automatic AK-47s or AR-15s or virtually any other modern current battlefield rifle you could imagine through federally licensed dealers, or you could buy them through private sales without undergoing any background check at all. When you talk about weapons that fire with select fire, which means they can fire either on semi-automatic fire or through full automatic fire, which means when you squeeze that trigger down and hold it, it will continue to spray fire from the gun until you release the trigger. Those guns are regulated more strictly in the United States. You do need a special license.
Alan Gottlieb is the founder of the nation's largest and oldest tax-exempt nonprofit, the Second Amendment Foundation. The foundation has been a pioneer in innovative defense of the right to keep and bear arms through its publications, public education programs, and legal action. Gottlieb says there is a reason why politics plays a role. 80 million gun owners equal 80 million voters.
And so when the other side, you know, comes out and talks about how there's an evil, powerful organization doing all this lobbying, or gun manufacturers doing this lobbying, what they're not taking into effect is that 80 million gun owners vote, and that's what makes it a potent political force in this country. When 80 million people want to protect their rights and vote to protect those rights, politicians pay attention and consider, you know, what it might take to get reelected. And as a result, that's why the gun rights movement is so politically potent.
Gottlieb says the laws that are in place are good and tight, and agrees that there is room for improvement when it comes to mental competency and owning a firearm.
Well, the laws that are in place that determine if you can pass a background check or not are good, and they're pretty solid. The problem we have is that in cases of mental illness, sometimes those records are not getting into the database when people are attempting to buy firearms. And that's a problem that we have in the record keeping and law enforcement. It's not a reason to have new laws put in place. It's probably a reason to try to make sure the data is not corrupted. We also have in that data, lots of times people find out they're disqualified from buying a firearm, and they're really not. It's just their name is similar to somebody else's, and as a result, their rights get violated. So it works both ways. Sometimes wrong people are getting firearms that shouldn't be, and sometimes people who should be able to get them are denied the purchase. So I'd like to see the database cleaned up a little bit and kept more accurately, and that's something that the federal government and the states need to work on.
Everett says there's really no reason to file down a serial number on a firearm, as shown so many times on multiple police detective shows, as all the owner has to do is show a police report stating that the gun was stolen.
No paperwork, not a single sheet of paper. There is no paper trail whatsoever for law enforcement to follow if that gun changes hands, and winds up at a crime scene. It is literally, and I would encourage your listeners, go to gun shows in North Carolina. You will see private sellers operating out of tables. You will see them wearing billboards on their bodies and carrying guns and selling them that way. They'll just be lingering about, and they will literally be doing cash and carry sales.
CSGV is comprised of 48 national organizations working to reduce gun violence.
The seller has no legal duty whatsoever to conduct a background check or to maintain any record of sale. Now, if as a federal agent or a state law enforcement agent, if you could prove that the private seller knew the buyer was a prohibited party, right, and he sold him the gun anyway, you could convict or you could indict that seller. But the problem is, if that person didn't have any duty to conduct a background check, how are they going to know if the person's a prohibited purchaser, right? And are they really going to admit to you if they knew that the person was a prohibited purchaser, let's say from the conversation that went on before the gun was sold? We need to realize this is totally unregulated. It is a free-for-all.
For more information, you can visit their website at csgv.org. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Downeast Journal. Showboats were once a common sight in the 1800s and 1900s, cruising the waterways of coastal North Carolina. Very little is known about showboats, only what is documented in plays, movies, and a fictional book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Stephen O'Connell has this, which originally aired in June of this year.
Edna Ferber wrote the book after extensive research, which included a four-night stay on the famous showboat, the James Adams Floating Theater. The boat was making stops on the Pamlico Sound in Bath and Belhaven, North Carolina. It's Miss Ferber's story that's really created the legacy of this unique aspect of early American entertainment. The dazzle that the movie business instilled into popular culture overshadows the flat-roofed houseboats that floated down the Mississippi, Ohio rivers, and extensive portions of the Atlantic coast. The movies of the 30s based on the lives of showboat performers might have caused people to think the idea was based on imagination. But from the early 1800s until the mid-20th century, showboats were providing entertainment equivalent to a circus. A typical showboat resembles a prop off a movie set. It's filled with some of the most passionate actors of the time, many of them families. One of the first recorded showboat appearances came by a Great Britain-born actor who moved with his family of nine and with them entertained up and down the waterways of the American frontier. Inside one of these barges, you might think you'd been transported to a city theater. Showboats were more appreciated in fishing towns, places within the deep and narrow confined waterways of rivers. What assistant manager for historic Bath, B. Latham, refers to as the guts of the river.
It seems to me that we find the barge-style showboats being very prevalent on the eastern shore from about the area of the Susquehanna River south, because the way those boats were designed were very easily able to ply up and down the small little guts off of rivers and creeks, which made them very popular.
Circuses were very popular in America in the 1830s when the first showboats appeared. In 1825, the circus tent was created, which allowed the circus to travel from city to city and put on one-night shows. The 1830s brought the railroad system, which further increased land travel efficiency. Even though the circus was more popular, showboats bore little resemblance and had a somewhat forgotten audience in the hard-to-reach towns that circuses could not compete with. Unlike the tents we all know from the circuses, showboats were built on the same scale and with similar techniques as a mansion from that time would have been built. And unlike the pyrotechnics and animal tricks that entertained the circus audience, the showboats are mostly known for their play productions and concerts. The showboat more resembled the traveling European shows of Shakespearean times. The circus and floating theater institutions struggled with the dawn of the movie industry in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Latham believes the early silent movies worked well for the typical showboat schedule.
At those times, I think the showboat ability and the silent movies probably went hand in hand for a period of time. The silent movie type atmosphere would have been able to provide entertainment during all times of the year. The showboat was really only able to provide their entertainments probably from the April to September time period, and then they were, you know, put away for the winter and work done to them as needed or upgraded.
In the early 1900s, the showboat business started losing prominence in the entertainment industry. As a result, a number of new showboats surfaced that were bigger and more extravagant. It was these showboats that caused people later to use the term showboat to refer to a person that excessively shows off a skill or talent. The showboat Miss Ferber was on, the James Adams Floating Theater, is one of the most famous showboats. In 1913, a circus operator named James Adams was interested in building a showboat. In 1914, after a stay in Washington, North Carolina, Adams completed his boat. It was a 436-ton, 128-foot-long, and 34-foot-wide barge. It soon came to be called the James Adams Floating Theater and was built in Washington, North Carolina. For most of its off-season in the winter, it docked at Elizabeth City. During the performance season, it traveled much of the Pamlico Sound and went further north into the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries in Virginia and Maryland. Latham quotes a Washington Daily News article from March 14, 1914, that describes Adams' early success.
The Adams Floating Theater played to a packed house each of the five nights and the Saturday matinee on the maiden introduction of floating entertainment to Beaufort County. The Washington Daily News of March the 5th, 1914, even estimated the crowd to have been between 700 and 800 the previous night. General admission was 10 cents. There were 100 choice reserved seats at an additional 25 cents, with another 200 reserved seats for 15 cents extra. Following the stint in Washington, Adams took his novelty to Greenville for a week, then back to the Beaufort County ports of Bath, Aurora, and Belhaven.
Other North Carolina towns the James Adams Floating Theater visited were Middletown, South Mills, Hertford, Edenton, Columbia, Plymouth, and Winton, among others. There were less visited towns, and the appreciation they received was proof. One unique aspect of the boats is that their size prevented them from having control over the boat. They used tugboats as a means to maneuver and get around, something that the famous showboat movies overlook. If they'd used steam engine wheels, the piece would have had to sit right in the middle of their main theater. According to the book, The James Adams Floating Theater, by Richard Gillespie, there was tension between the entertainers and the tugboat crew on Adams' boat. While the tugboat crew was trying to sleep, the actors and actresses were practicing late into the night, and in the mornings when the crew was getting the barge en route, the performers were trying to sleep. Despite the conflicts aboard such a confined place of work, Adams' theater became quite popular.
The way that James Adams operated, as I'm sure other showboats did as well, they would usually stay in a town 5 to 7 days, and they provided a different play each of those days.
Adams said that most popular were the shows that could shed a tear but would have you leaving with a smile on your face. Latham reads from an old magazine article that interviewed R.H. Carson from Urbana, Virginia. Latham quotes Carson speaking of the months leading up to the floating theater's arrival.
The real highlight of the year was the arrival of the floating theater, which always came around the middle of August for a one-week stay. People came in droves, some from as far away as Richmond, which was 75 miles of dirt road from Urbana. But what I recall best of all was the yearly arrival of the advance man. Some 3 or 4 weeks before the arrival of the floating theater, he would arrive on the steamer from Norfolk. He arranged for the dock rental, for advertising in the local weekly newspaper, and for young and eager 16-year-old boys to tack up signs on nearly every tree and telephone pole within a 25-mile radius.
There's currently a nonprofit out of Indian Head, Maryland, set to build a replica of the James Adams Floating Theater that might even travel and entertain along the same routes as did Adams and his crew. If you're interested in the experience of the floating theater, take a ferry ride over the Pamlico Sound from Aurora to Bath and try to imagine children chasing the boat on its way in or the sound of instruments across the water showcasing its imminent arrival. You might also read Ferber's book, Showboat, and maybe then you'll see that the history of showboats is better off as part myth. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Carolina East Health System, New Bern, caring for coastal North Carolina families for 50 years. Carolina East Health System, your partner in health, online at carolinaeasthealth.com. In April, we brought you a story about exploding hog farms, a phenomenon that's been occurring in the Midwest. Funny as it seems, this is actually a serious issue. When the pits that can hold up to 8 feet of manure burst, it's a big mess, and in some cases, thousands of lost livestock and millions of dollars in damage. Scientists have determined that methane-packed foam that expands on top of the deep manure pits that are common throughout the Midwest region is likely the cause. Professor and extension engineer for the University of Minnesota, Larry Jacobson, says the foam builds up to the point that hog farmers must beat it down.
Foam can develop on the surface of the stored manure, and this can create loss of storage space, but probably most importantly, the foam captures the methane gas that is released during the digestion or anaerobic digestion that naturally occurs with manure that's stored that long.
When agitators, which help break down solids, are turned on and the foam is broken down rapidly, all of the methane is released into a confined space in a short period of time. If methane trapped inside the building reaches high enough concentration levels and an ignition source is introduced, it could result in an explosion.
There's been several cases where it's totally destroyed the barn. So I would rate that as a fairly large explosion.
Of course, the size of the explosion depends on the concentration level of methane in the air. Jacobson says, at the very least, hog farmers may experience a flash fire, which is similar to a fireball created when a gas stove ignition is delayed. Out of approximately 20 hog farm explosions that have occurred in the past 3 years, heaters have been the main ignition source. However, in September 2011, a spark from a welder caused an explosion in Iowa that killed 1,500 hogs and injured a worker. Exploding hog farms have been an issue in states like Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, Nebraska, and Indiana. But since North Carolina is ranked second in the nation for hog production, could an explosion occur here? To find out, we spoke to Dr. Tom Ray, who is the North Carolina Agriculture and Consumer Services Director of Livestock Health Programs.
We contacted some of the veterinarians that work with the larger hog companies. In North Carolina, you can talk to three companies, and with those three companies, you're discussing 90% of the farms and about 95% of the animals. And talking with the company veterinarians, we had history going back over 20 years, and there were none of these instances that have occurred to anyone's knowledge in the state, either to their own companies or anecdotally from discussing it with other swine veterinarians and companies and independent producers.
Eastern North Carolina's hog industry began around the 1980s and experienced record growth throughout the 90s. There are approximately 1,200 hog farms in North Carolina, many of these in the eastern portion of the state. According to the latest figures from the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, Lenoir and Pitt counties are ranked 10th in the nation for hog production. Jones County ranks 8th, Greene County is 7th, Pender is 5th, and Wayne County is ranked 4th. Duplin County is the top hog-producing county in our state, with over 2 million of North Carolina's 8.6 million hogs. While hog farm explosions are very rare, even in the Midwest, it's highly unlikely one will ever happen here. That's because there are some major differences between the way hog farms are built in the Midwest and here in eastern North Carolina.
A lot of the barns in the Midwest employ a manure storage vessel below the pigs. It's called deep pit storage.
Don Butler is the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Murphy Brown, LLC, located in Duplin County. Murphy Brown is one of the largest hog-producing companies in the state.
Typically, those pits may be 6 or 8 feet deep, and as the waste material leaves the animals, falls through slotted floors into this containment area, and is stored until the farmers are ready to use it as a fertilizer.
Hog houses in North Carolina generally do not have deep pits, and they are much more shallow, about 4 feet. Similar to the Midwestern design, the waste falls through slits in the floor into a collection pit below. But the difference is that the pit is flushed on a regular basis to an open-air lagoon for long-term storage. Hog operations in eastern North Carolina typically have flaps that roll up to allow for natural ventilation, preventing high concentrations of methane to build up inside the building. In the Midwest, most hog operations have solid walls and are ventilated using large fans. According to the North Carolina Pork Council's executive director, Deborah Johnson, foaming appears to be isolated to deep pit manure storage systems, and there appears to be no clear-cut cause for the foaming. Even though the factors that cause the hog farm explosions are still being researched, professor and extension engineer for the University of Minnesota, Larry Jacobson, believes the animal's diet could be to blame.
Things that have been identified or finger-pointed at mostly is the feeding of distillers grain solubles, or DDG, which is a byproduct of producing ethanol. We have a lot of DDGs that are available in the Midwest, and it's can be supplemented into the animal pig feed. I think it has lined up with the increase of the feeding of DDGs.
According to National Hog Farmer Magazine, the estimated use of DDGs in swine diets has drastically increased since 2001. Some say the foam is a result of bacterial growth in the manure pits. However, the origins of the mysterious gray foam may never be known. But Jacobson says they are doing their best to get the word out to farmers in the Midwest about the possibility of hog farm explosions and how to prevent them from happening. Jacobson says about a dozen explosions have occurred throughout the Midwest since 2009. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East.